Good morning and welcome to The Bridge, a weekly news presentation of Coast Community Radio. I'm David Paul. Perhaps no literary figure is more emblematic of Oregon than Ken Kesey. The author, who died in 2001, left behind a voluminous collection of manuscripts and drawings, and for the past several years, contemporary Oregon author and educator Matt Love has waged a guerrilla campaign to keep the Kesey archives in state and to make them available to scholars. Here's the story.
Ken Kesey is inarguably the greatest Oregon writer of all time, whose two seminal novels, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, published in 1962 when he was 27, and Sometimes a Great Notion, published in 1964 when he was 29 years old, certainly just defined Oregon literature, particularly Sometimes a Great Notion, almost single-handedly established a sense of place for Pacific Northwest, nature writing, fiction, two huge books, put him on the map. He was under 30. And of course, many people know of Kesey as, of course, the Merry Prankster, and the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, and Tom Wolfe, and his being a counterculture titan in his later years. But the books, him as a writer, growing up in Springfield and attending the University of Oregon, So he's a cultural legend in Oregon. He's internationally known and nationally known, but the Pacific Northwest is his roots, and his fanatics are here among us.
And I guess he left behind quite a collection of papers.
Yes. From what I understand, he was also a wonderful artist. And he, for instance, he illustrated his jail journals when he was serving time for that marijuana bust down in California. And so he was an illustrator, and he annotated his manuscripts and with little drawings, and I've seen them, and they're truly works of art. And he left behind a lot of papers, a lot of correspondence, manuscripts, scraps of this and that, and the family had in their possession quite a while. They were being temporarily stored at the University of Oregon's archives, at the library there, the Knight Library Archives, but they were not accessible. And a couple of years ago, the rumor sort of came down in the Oregon literary community that the Kesey family was, they'd always intended to sell them to the University of Oregon, because that's the way the game works. I mean, you donate your papers or you sell them to universities so they can, be used with scholars and fans. But we caught wind that there, perhaps Stanford, where he went to graduate school, or the University of Texas at Austin, which is an internationally renowned place of literary archives, were interested in purchasing the Kesey archives from the family. And, I mean, many of us were just like aghast, like these things can't leave Oregon. They can't leave Eugene. Because the people that really write about Kesey and care about Kesey and his work and his art live in this area, and it would be just abomination to have the Kesey archives in Texas. So that's sort of the genesis of my little renegade cultural activism that I undertook about 2 years ago.
And tell us about that campaign.
Well, I wrote a book called Sometimes a Great Movie, about the filming of Sometimes a Great Notion in Lincoln County in the summer of 1970 with Paul Newman and the Stamper family saga. And so that book came out in the spring of 2012, and I toured it all over the state. And at the time, the Kesey archives were, that's when they were in play about being sold and maybe, leaving the state. So what I did, I did about 30 or 40 events for that book all over the Western Oregon, basically. And I decided I wanted to do something to help keep the archives in the state of Oregon. So what I did is I bought all these vintage postcards, Oregon postcards. Sometimes I got, 500 for a quarter at a thrift store. Okay, I went all over just digging up all these old Oregon postcards. And then at the events, I would have the people in the audience fill out the postcard. I had addressed it to Phil Knight of Nike fame, with the Beaverton campus address, and I asked Oregonians to ask Phil Knight to purchase the archives, and then you could sign them if you wanted. And so we must have done 1,000 during that 2012 period, maybe early into 2013, and I simply put a postcard stamp on them and then mailed them to the Beaverton campus, not knowing if this they were ever going to Knight was going to see them or what the issue was. And I asked, I was trying to get the Oregonians out there to ask Knight, because of course he'd done a lot for the university. I mean, and the Health Sciences Center, but he'd also done a lot for the athletic program. So I thought, and the archives were valued, I heard later, you know, roughly $1.2 million. Well, you know, that's probably 100 square feet of the new football center, you know, that was just paid for. So it was just something I thought that, you know, Mr. Knight would be inclined to want to do, cut a check, keep them here, keep them in Oregon. And so we started sending these postcards out. Didn't think anything of it until something happened this last summer.
And what was that?
Well, I received a call from a woman, I can't remember her name now, a charming woman who was the development director of the Knight Library in Eugene at the University of Oregon. And she was basically in charge of sort of the archives, raising funds for that sort of thing. And she said, Matt, there's an effort, a private fundraising effort going on that I'm in charge of to try to raise funds to purchase the Kesey archives and keep them in Oregon. I was just like, great. And she had heard of that I'd written a book about the movie and that I'd written extensively about Kesey and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, etc. And she says, I'm just trying to meet some Oregonians who are interested and I'm willing to come down and visit you in Newport, where I was living at the time. I said, great, come on down. You can buy me lunch. And so we met at Cafe Stephanie in Newport, and she started talking about the plans that were underway, that like the Rogue Brewery had donated $100,000. You know, Voodoo Donuts had donated $10,000 because they had this special Ken Kesey donut or something. Like, all this stuff was happening under this under the radar with virtually no press that was going on. And she told me that she had very good news for me, and she said, well, the new president of University of Oregon has purchased the Kesey archives. He pulled some the money out of operation costs so it would stay here. But that was always intended to be repaid by the library. So they still needed to raise money to, you know, refund the university, because you shouldn't really use operating money to buy these archives. And then also, of course, the issue with the Kesey archives is that they're not accessible. They're not digitized. They're not being displayed. So there needs to be a lot more money to actually make them accessible to scholars. So she was saying, you know, it was interesting. This woman, the development director, was saying, I was just on a vacation in Hawaii, and I got a call. And it was from Phil Knight's personal secretary saying, hey, we're getting all these postcards from somebody, we don't know what it's connected to, but it's asking us to put in a donation. And Mr. Knight thought he had done that, and she informed him that he had not. And so this woman is sitting across the table from me in Cafe Stephanie Newport and says, we don't know who that guy is. And I said, you're looking at him right here. I did this. And I continued to do it. My new book had come out called Of Walking in Rain, which was inspired by Sometimes a Great Notion, sort of a nonfiction account of my relationship with Rain. And so I'd been continuing to send the postcards. We were probably now up to a couple thousand, maybe, you know, I don't know. I didn't keep track of them. I read every one of them before we mailed them. Some of them were outrageous, nothing profane or anything like that, just little haikus. They did drawings. If they had a personal relationship to Mr. Knight, they'd gone to University of Oregon. If they had run with him on the U of O track team or whatever, there was just somebody was just help us out. So I said, is he going to pony up? She says, well, he hasn't yet, but we're getting the dialogue going. So I continued to do that, to send the postcards out. Now with saying, hey, they're here in Oregon, but now we're almost there. We're almost across the finish line. Let's get some more money. Maybe Mr. Knight can pony up and get them digitized so all these scholars and high school kids and college kids can go online and look at a manuscript by Ken Kesey, particularly if you're teaching Sometimes a Great Notion or One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And so I thought we were almost there. And then where it is today, I'm still sending postcards. I mean, I got a new leg on my spring book tour with the Rain book, and I'm going to keep doing it until it works or it doesn't work. Or with the ultimate goal is I just would like to sit down with Mr. Knight and make a personal pitch as an Oregon writer and teacher. And maybe if he could give me 5 minutes of his time, I wouldn't have to keep sending all these postcards, because it's adding up. It's costing me a little bit of money here and there.
Phil Knight, are you listening? How can people get involved, Matt?
Send a postcard to the Beaverton campus. That's what I did. And I didn't sign these. It must have been a bit of a mystery to them, because they didn't know where they were going to get him, what they were getting. Some of these were in red crayon, or I had crayons, I had pencils. I mean, I was trying to make them look a little psychedelic, too, honoring Mr. Kesey. So, yeah. And the people wrote so well in these things. I mean, I was astounded. I almost wanted to save a couple of them, but I didn't. And they were just writing. I mean, people really write well when they care about something. So in these little 50-word blasts of Mr. Knight, they wrote incredibly well. Oregonians writing well to preserve Oregon's greatest writer. I thought that was great.
It'd be great if you could collect those and publish them.
You know, I thought about scanning them or taking some pictures with my camera, but it just got so moving so fast. Yeah. And I was constantly mailing them out. And maybe sometimes things are just meant to be ephemeral, go out to the world. And I'm assuming that they kept them at the Nike headquarters. So any Oregonian that's out there, you write Phil Knight, care of the Beaverton campus, send him a postcard, vintage Oregon, the better, and just ask. That's all we can do. You know, you just ask people who have the means, and, you know, we don't begrudge what happened, some of the other beneficiaries of his philanthropy. Great stuff, but there's always more to do.
So there you go. Grab those vintage postcards and address them to Phil Knight at Nike headquarters in Beaverton. Now, if you've been to the beach lately, you might be wondering what happened to all the starfish. Well, a deadly disease has been wiping out West Coast starfish for more than a year. The syndrome causes the starfish to melt into piles of mush. One place where the disease has been held off, though, is up in Alaska, and scientists recently traveled there to search for new clues. EarthFix reporter Katie Campbell has the story.
It's early morning in Sitka, Alaska. The stars have yet to fade from the night sky, and a group of scientists is setting out in search of a different kind of star. Sea stars, commonly known as starfish, have been vanishing from North America's Pacific shoreline.
I need this bag, and then I'll jump off.
Pete Raimondi is one of the lead scientists studying the alarming epidemic that's been killing starfish by the millions. Scientists believe that warming waters or an infectious pathogen are to blame. But no one knows for certain.
This is if you found a Pycnopodia.
Raimondi's team is conducting intensive surveys of Pacific coastal areas.
Almost everywhere we've looked in the last year, we've seen catastrophic losses of sea stars.
They noticed signs of the disease in Sitka last year, but there hasn't been a die-off until now. The researchers can't stop an outbreak, but they can count and measure the creatures that live here in an effort to help track the spread of the disease. Raimondi pounds bolts into rocks. His team uses measuring tape to rope off a patch of shoreline. They'll study this area over time to see how the starfish are doing.
8 left of area.
110.
Raimondi crouches on the rocks. He aims his flashlight into the cracks and crevices. He's hunting for a tiny six-armed star called a Leptosterius, or Lepta for short.
These cracks from the previous years, they've been full of guys. And,
you guys didn't get any last time either, did you? Back in June.
Their data has provided a critical point of comparison for what normal starfish populations have been in the past.
If you don't know what's there, you won't know what's lost.
I've got one mildly sick lepta.
Raimondi inspects a lepta up close. Even at full size, the star fits in the palm of his hand. Symptoms of the wasting syndrome vary depending on the species of starfish, but Raimondi says it usually starts the same way.
If they get white lesions, they become necrotic. That means the tissue dies. And as the tissue dies, they oftentimes will lose arms and then waste away. We call it wasting away. They disintegrate.
Nearby, researcher Melissa Miner finds an ochre star that looks even sicker. Two of its arms are ghostly white, like they've been dipped in candle wax.
So this animal here is probably the worst one that we've seen today. And you can see it's diseased pretty heavily along this arm. And then it's also spreading onto this arm.
Sea star wasting syndrome now affects almost every species of West Coast starfish. The plague has hit so hard over the past year that biologists fear some species could even go extinct. Researchers believe that a virus or a bacteria may be the root of the problem. Ramondi and Miner will ship some samples to other researchers who are trying to figure out which virus or bacteria is causing this.
So this is a healthy Pycnopodia. No signs of lesions.
Drew Harvell is a marine epidemiologist working at the University of Washington's Friday Harbor Labs. She's been coordinating nationwide research into the wasting syndrome, and she says the team is close to identifying a pathogen.
This is what we call a wide host range pathogen. It means that it affects many different species, and those are the most dangerous in wildlife disease in terms of a potential risk of extinction.
Scientists think warm water could play a role in triggering the outbreaks. Starfish are stressed by higher temperatures, which make them more vulnerable to infection. As die-offs continue in Puget Sound and along the coast of Oregon, scientists are looking north for a sign of hope.
The hope is that the waters are cold enough in Alaska, the northern part of the range, for many of these species, that they'll persist there.
Triazaster 70.
Scientists hope that Sitka will mark the northern edge of the wasting syndrome. As long as there's still pockets of healthy stars, Pete Ramondi says recovery is possible. That's because baby starfish can float in the water for up to 45 days, and ocean currents can carry them hundreds of miles from where they were born.
And so that allows there to be replenishment downstream from populations upstream that are unaffected. That's why it's critical to go north to find whether there are still extant populations that are healthy.
Starfish farther north in Juneau seem to be holding strong. And if that continues, parts of Alaska could still serve as a refuge from the disease. I'm Katie Campbell, reporting.
You're listening to The Bridge on Coast Community Radio, 91.9 KMUN in Astoria, 89.5 KTCB in Tillamook. We're streaming live on the web at coastradio.org. You can hear us on your mobile device by using the TuneIn app. Today's weather forecast calls for sunny skies with highs 65 to 70, nighttime lows around 55, tomorrow cloudy with rain, and highs around 65 degrees. State lawmakers often work in relative obscurity when you compare them to their D.C. Beltway counterparts, but the men and women in Boise, Olympia, and Salem frequently vote on bills that have a direct impact on the lives of you and me. That's one reason why political parties in the Northwest are working hard this fall to win as many statehouse seats as possible. Salem correspondent Chris Lehman looks at how the campaigns are shaking out in Oregon.
Picture yourself on the floor of the Oregon Senate last summer. It's the closing days of session, and tensions are high. There's a highly controversial bill on the floor that would automatically sign eligible people up to vote when they get their driver's license. Supporters call it good government. Opponents call it an invasion of privacy.
Voting no, Bearsugar, Boquist.
And when the votes were tallied up,
Starr, Thompson, Whitsitt, Winters, 15 aye votes.
They got 15 votes, but you need 16 votes to pass a bill in the Oregon Senate. So Senate President Peter Courtney quickly pronounced it dead.
House Bill 3521B, having failed to receive a constitutional majority, has failed.
That was the day I started to seriously consider running.
Sarah Gelser was on the floor of the Oregon Senate that day. She's a four-term state representative. Since the House was in recess, she wandered over to the upper chamber to watch the fate of a measure she had enthusiastically voted for just days earlier. It was a fate that was familiar to Gelser and other Democrats in the Oregon legislature.
For many years, we have passed really good legislation in the House and watched it go over to the Senate and die by just one vote.
Now, a bit of explanation is in order here. Democrats actually do control the Oregon Senate, 16-14, but one of their members often votes with Republicans on social and environmental issues, and that leaves Democrats hoping upon hope for one more seat. They think Sarah Gelser is one of their best chances to pick up that seat this November. As a state representative, Gelser has served the more liberal part of the Willamette Valley Senate District since 2007. It's home to Oregon State University. Now she's reaching out to voters in the more blue-collar portion of the district. But she says the people in both halves of the district are interested in the same things.
quality education that meets the needs of all students, access to affordable higher education, freezing tuition costs, the right for people to make their own decisions, whether that's who they marry or when and whether they have children.
To win, Gelser will have to knock off Republican Betsy Close. Close is technically the incumbent, but this is the first time she'll face voters as a state senator. That's because she was appointed to fill the remainder of the term of another senator who resigned. Close did not respond to our repeated requests for an interview. She's running ads that portray her as a bipartisan dealmaker.
Hi, I'm Betsy Close. If we can just put partisanship aside and reach across party lines, there is so much that we can accomplish. That's what I'll be working on.
Her critics point to her voting record and say she's one of the legislature's most conservative members. Here's a Gelser ad.
Reject Betsy Close. Far right, all wrong for us.
Voters in Albany and Corvallis can expect to see plenty more of those ads between now and Election Day, and it's not the only Oregon Senate race that could come down to the wire. But Pacific University political analyst Jim Moore says he doesn't expect the balance of power to shift.
The odds are it's going to stay a 16-14 Senate for the Democrats, but we're not quite sure which Democrat or which Republican in those districts is going to be actually sitting in the legislature.
Moore expects similar results in the Oregon House. Some seats will change parties, but he thinks Democrats will hold on to their majority. One thing's for sure, there'll be a lot of new faces in Salem. Nearly one in five lawmakers who were on the floor during the last full-length session won't be back in the next one. I'm Chris Lehman in Salem.
Maybe you remember those shiny red delicious apples they used to serve you in your grade school cafeteria? Well, Washington growers are expecting a record crop of apples this year, but not of red delicious. Most American consumers have moved on, and as Rowan Moore Garrity reports, growers are doing their best to keep up.
Grower Rob McCormick stoops to examine a knotty tree trunk in an apple orchard in Selo, Washington.
See right here? These actually had been red delicious. This was cut down just to a stump, and then we grafted in the Galas.
At the height of their popularity, red delicious accounted for more than two-thirds of Washington apples. Today, the variety represents just over a quarter of the fruit grown here. Prices have fallen dramatically. Frequently now, old varieties like Red and Golden Delicious cost more to produce than you can sell them for.
Everything is worth something. Sometimes that something is less than nothing.
McCormick says there are years he lets his harvest fall to the ground.
Is that an easy thing to do? Can I be dispassionate about it? No. You know, I've produced these things. It would be a hard thing to waste them.
Galas are originally from New Zealand. In 30 years, they've taken the place of Red Delicious as America's most popular apple. But McCormick says there are still profitable years for Reds, too. So he's converted some Reds to Galas, but not all.
That was more of a gamble than I wanted to take.
In 35 years growing apples, McCormick says he's seen more than one fellow grower invest heavily in a new variety and end up taking a loss. Reds are cheap and reliable to grow. They don't require a lot of special treatment. He tugs at a Red Delicious dangling from a branch.
When that is mature, it will be as good at eating apple as you can find.
David Nelly disagrees.
Red Delicious was introduced some time ago, and I dare say that people's expectations have risen since then.
Nelly directs apple and pear operations for a marketing firm called Oppenheimer.
The specifications that some of the retailers require from us have changed.
Today's apples are sweeter and more crisp. They have a longer shelf life. First there was Gala, then Fuji, and now Honeycrisp.
It's the rock star of the apple world in North America right now. There's no doubt.
Last year, a box of Honeycrisp apples fetched nearly three times as much as a box of Red Delicious. As more and more growers get in on the action, quality control becomes key. Somewhere,
there is a consumer who walks down to their store, picks up a Honeycrisp, and they may have one that was picked a little bit too early or grown in the wrong place. During this gold rush of the Honeycrisp years, So that person is going to, you know, think, wow, that's not what I remember a Honeycrisp tasted like.
When that happens too many times, prices will fall. So some growers are trying a new strategy to avoid this cycle of boom and bust. Parking his truck in a hillside orchard south of Yakima, Dave Allen shows me how.
Pacific Rose is a big apple, and it will get a brighter red. It's kind of a pinky-colored red. Beautiful apple. And what's neat about this Pacific Rose, after storage, you get this kind of aroma that comes out of it. And
all these qualities make Allen think Pacific Rose could be the next Honeycrisp. But it's not his only bet. Aided by DNA sequencing and advanced computing, the number of new varieties is exploding, like an apple called Envy.
Envy's the last one we had, and it came as a number, and I don't even remember the number now.
Both Envy and Pacific Rose are known as club varieties, as in, you can only grow them if you're part of the club. What that means is that breeders trademark their new creations, then license the right to grow and sell them to hand-picked partners. Together, they invest a lot in building a new brand, and they limit production.
You want to make sure that you don't plant so many trees that you're not able to sell the fruit when it actually gets to the market.
That's Suzanne Walter. She oversees marketing operations for the Rainier Fruit Company, one of Washington's largest apple producers. She says trademark protection allows companies to invest more in marketing their new varieties, so they avoid the fate of an apple called Cameo.
Growers were getting more yield, and we were packing more fruit, but consumers didn't buy it. People didn't know about it.
Delicious, but hard to sell. Walking through his orchard, Rob McCormick says he's got a few other varieties to add to that list. Braeburn and Firm Gold, which he calls a superior apple.
They're firmer, they store better. Look how big they get. See, look at the size of that thing. Man, you know, how can that not be worth something?
He says it's a bit arbitrary which varieties ultimately win out for shelf space in the grocery store. All the same,
we can't tell people what they want. What they want is what they want. You either grow what they want or find another business.
And for now, he's sticking to apples. I'm Rowan Moore-Garrity in Yakima.
And that's about all the time we have this week for The Bridge, a weekly news production of Coast Community Radio in collaboration with the Northwest News Network. Hope you can join us again next Thursday morning at 9. In the meantime, this is David Paul wishing you a very good day.